Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikulskas, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Alex Kershaw. He is an author and a historian, out with his latest book, The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. It's available now wherever your fine books are sold. Alex, how far into writing this book did you decide to call it The First Wave?
I decided on the title right at the beginning because I was thinking about how I was going to try and tell a new story about D-Day, which has been written about many, many times. So I thought, you know what, let's just pick the guys that had the hardest jobs, that where the stakes were highest and the odds of living longest, you know, the guys that had the toughest jobs. And I realized that was the first wave, the very first guys to fight.
Take me back to that time as they're preparing this. There was a couple of day window when this could happen. What was the immediacy like for the generals who were there in the room getting this all set?
They were very, very worried. They were worried about many things. Eisenhower, the Supreme Commander, was worried above all by the weather. We were able to find at the last minute, literally, a window of around about 18 hours when the English Channel was not going to be storm-tossed, when we stood a chance of landing craft in Normandy. But it was very, very close run. It was a very tense time. Not one senior Allied general or planner was 100% confident of success. We had no plan B, so if we failed, that would have been it. We would never have gone back. So the stakes were the highest you can imagine in the 20th century for any massive battle. We had to succeed, but no one was assured of success.
Was this Eisenhower's baby completely?
No, it was several men's babies. Eisenhower was the only guy who could pull the trigger and start the invasion. He famously said, "Okay, let's go," around about 4:30 in the morning on the 5th of June. Winston Churchill, Roosevelt, you name it, Marshall, the King of England, no one could give that authority to begin the invasion. So it was an enormous responsibility. I mean, you know, I can't think of a greater pressure on one man's shoulders than to be the guy that finally gives the decision and is in control of the most important amphibious invasion in history. But he did so, and was not confident of success. He had a note in his uniform pocket, and it was basically to the effect that everybody has done their very best, but I alone take responsibility for the failure of this invasion. So here's a guy ordering over 170,000 Allied troops to storm the beaches of Normandy, and yet in his uniform pocket he has a note which he's about to read out, he believes, in case of failure. And notably, honorably, beautifully, he took responsibility all on his own shoulders.
We see in modern times, I think of the Osama bin Laden assassination raid, and we've seen the pictures of the president in the Situation Room with his cabinet members and high level, the Joint Chiefs of Staff. What was the communication like with the White House at the time? I mean, obviously there wasn't the communications we have now, but as far as giving him the green light, he didn't have to check with anybody once he had that green light, right?
No, absolutely. The conditions were, you know, no one was phoning up Eisenhower on the 4th, 5th of June and saying, okay, you go when we say. Eisenhower had that authority all the way through as Allied Supreme Commander. From when he came to England in January 1944, he knew that ultimately it was his decision and his decision alone. It could not be a political decision. It had to be purely on military terms. He was responsible for the lives of at least 170,000 Allied troops on D-Day, and the buck stopped absolutely with him.
What are the ages of the soldiers we're talking about here?
Well, if you go to the Normandy American Graveyard at Colville-sur-Mer and you walk around the 9,500 American dead, over 20,000 Americans killed during the Battle of Normandy, the average age is 22 or 23. So you're talking about, you know, young men. In fact, of those who are buried in Normandy in that one graveyard, if you add up, if you think that they could have perhaps lived to the age of 75, most of them, which their peers who survived did, then there are over 600,000 human life years that were sacrificed on D-Day and in the Battle of Normandy. That's an awful lot of human potential and life, you know. They were young. Most of them had not seen combat. Only one division that landed from the sea, the big red one, had seen combat before. They were young. They were inexperienced. When they died, many of them didn't cry for God, or they cried for their mothers. And that tells you an awful lot.
Were these guys who had plans of going into the military, or were these people that were pursuing another career path and all of a sudden the draft pulls them in?
Nearly all of them were drafted. Some of them had served in National Guard units in the 1930s. The unit that suffered the highest losses on D-Day was Company A from the 116th Infantry Regiment, the Bedford Boys. I wrote a book about them. And they, out of 180 guys that landed in the first wave, 102 were killed. Not wounded, not taken prisoner, 102 out of 180 men killed in just a few minutes. So they all joined the National Guard in the 1930s. National Guard units from all over America served in the Pacific and in Europe. And these guys had joined up like a lot of guys do today. You know, they became weekend warriors. They could put food on the table because they got paid a dollar every time they went to a drill practice. So, you know, imagine being in 1937-38 at the height of the Depression. You're trying to feed your family. You join the National Guard. And then 6 years later, you're in the first wave in that landing craft coming in to the most lethal beach in history for Americans, which was Omaha Beach.
And as you talk to, I mean, there's some survivors, and I know you talked to one in particular. Is this something that's on their minds every day?
No, they never forget. I mean, you know, imagine the worst car crash you've been in, or if you have been in one, you never forget that trauma. You never forget what it did to your nervous system. You never forget the experience. Many of them came back from the war and tried to forget, but the guys that I talked to couldn't forget. They couldn't forget. They didn't want to forget towards the end of their lives. They were immensely affected by what they went through. They were damaged. They had been psychologically really wounded by war, but they were also immensely proud of that they had been a part of the greatest achievement in American history, which is to have liberated Western Europe.
All right, the book is The First Wave, The D-Day Warriors Who Led the Way to Victory in World War II. He's Alex Kershaw, the author and historian responsible for putting this out. Alex, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
My pleasure.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
D-Day!